We've got the Academy Awards, the Emmys, and Grammys. But what should we call the award for the most extraordinary performance by a corporate profiteer? How about the Sleazy, with winners getting a solid gold sculpture of a middle finger? There were so many worthy contenders, but one corporation exhibited uncommon callousness, so the 2021 Sleazy goes to Tyson Foods. The meatpacking giant has regularly run roughshod over workers, farmers, communities, and the environment, not to mention the millions of animals it fattens and slaughters. But the coronavirus pulled out the worst in Tyson's corporate ethic. Last April, its billionaire chair, John Tyson, ranted that health officials who were closing down several of his slaughterhouses that had become hotbeds of contagion were creating another crisis, a national meat shortage. Responding instantly, our corporate compassionate burger-gobbling president decreed that meatpacking plants were crucial to America's national security and must be kept open at all cost. Trump's edict required workers to return to their jobs or be fired. Only, there was no meat shortage. Indeed, Tyson and other giants actually increased their meat exports to China last year. Meanwhile, COVID rampaged through Tyson's factories. In its Waterloo, Iowa facility alone, a third of the processing workers were infected and at least six died. Which brings us to the corporate play that cinched this year's Sleazy for Tyson. Waterloo slaughterhouse supervisors actually knew that the back-to-work order would sicken hundreds, but not exactly how many. So, managers organized a winner-take-all betting pool on the percent of employees who would test positive. It was simply something fun, said one, kind of a morale boost. This is Jim Hightower saying the virus infected more than a third of the workers in the plant. Some fun, huh? The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got to be honest, you know, when you look at the fact that they're saying, the Republicans, all of them are saying $3.5 trillion is just way too much money to spend on people, on investing in the country. I'm like, you know, are you kidding? You think of how much the Republican Party has given to the handful in this country, and some Democrats too. There's no one gets a pass totally in this. These policies were all pushed through. They were lobbied heavily. There was campaign cash that filled coffers. The wealth class of this country has known how to spread it around. And the one thing that the former guy said that I absolutely agreed with and was true is that when he was just a businessman, he bought them all. That's how politics is played in the corporate and the wealth world. They'll give a little bit here, a little bit here, buy a little bit of allegiance where they can, and then call in those markers when it's time to pay off. As my grandfather always said, if a rich guy tells you, spends a dollar to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it, because they understand return on investment. For every dollar the Koch brothers have put into political action, they've reaped probably 10 back in tax cuts or deregulation or ways to shortchange we the people. Rich people don't get rich by being stupid and giving money away without any payback coming back to them. And for them, politics is an investment, and a very lucrative investment. You stop and you think about it. You give a congressman $20,000 and they vote on a bill that's going to give you $500 million tax cut. Was that a good investment? You bet it was. And look, I hope people are as outraged when they look at the Bezoses and the Elon Musks and the billionaire class that we've created, our wealth, our work, our sweat, our blood, our tears, our sacrifice has created. You know, I had someone to tell me that, well, we need more people like Elon Musk. I'm going, no, we need working people who are able to take what idea Elon Musk has in his head and actually put it into physical structure. We need craftsmen who are well compensated, who are well respected. Yeah, we need ideas people. But I'm sorry, it doesn't mean we created Jeff Bezos, who's worth, you know, just obscene amounts. And the fact that, you know, as this ProPublica piece points out, his wealth grew from 2014 to 2018 by $99 billion. and paid a true tax rate of 1%. That is staggering to me. And then 7 and 11 paid zero. Elon Musk, his wealth grew by $23.9 billion from 14 to 18. He paid half of what Bezos paid. His tax rate was 3.27%. Musk paid zero federal income tax in 2018. And yet these guys are playing with toys in space and giant bathtub boats and all of this stuff. You got Musk today, you know, mocking the president because he's got the wealth to be able to do that. We've allowed a handful of people the kind of wealth that can crush our economy. Over this pandemic, our billionaire class got 62% richer. They lined their pockets with another $1.8 trillion. And I keep hearing, but Rick, we don't have the money to invest that $3.5 trillion over 10 years. We don't have the $350 billion a year to ensure that kids get education, that you know, preschool, universal pre-K, community college. We don't have the money to help granny get new chompers and hearing aids. Sorry, can't do that. We're broke. We can't invest in long-term health care. We can't invest in any of the things that are going to actually help working families. This is what they're telling you. Sorry, we'd like to help you. We'd like to help you with your meager problems. We'd like to help you. Yeah, you know, granny's on the way out. You know, better luck next time. We'd love to help, but we're broke. We don't have it because we've got to give it away. I find that disgraceful, literally disgraceful. And the thing is they've trained us for generations to anytime we hear they're going to raise taxes to just foam at the mouth. And you could blame someone like Grover Norquist for that. Who in his organization, it's all about the anger at the IRS and getting people as angry as they can at taxes. And look, nobody likes to pay them. Again, I don't like paying them either. When my bill comes at the end of the year, my accountant goes, write that big check. I almost cry. But I also understand it's how we invest in our country. It's how there will be a future for our children. It's how I was able to get an education. It's how I'm able to have a business. But yet, we've got our billionaire class who thinks they should be entitled to everything because we've been told, this is what we've been told for 40 years. If we give everything to them, they'll be benevolent and they will share. Are they sharing? Oh, I know. Jeff Bezos is creating jobs at Amazon that are now paying $18 an hour, and good for him. That's only because he can't find people. But those jobs should be $30 an hour jobs. Because 30 years ago, that's close to what they were. Because they were good union jobs. They were family-sustaining jobs. And for me, I'm looking at this moment, and going back to my conversation with Sarah Seltzer, this is a moment in my view of real possible change, of real radical change, to maybe accomplish what my grandparents' generation were able to do. The idea that wages rise to a significant level, that maybe you can exist on one income, that the possibility of that could come back, that families could decide that, you know what, we're going to sacrifice a little bit over here so that we can have someone stay home and raise our children so we don't have to put them into daycare. Because you're seeing people leaving daycare now because the wages are pathetic. You're seeing people leaving the restaurant industry because wages are terrible. Conditions are terrible. You're seeing a realignment of low-wage work in this country. And how is that going to affect people going up the socioeconomic ladder? Does that mean maybe we become more family-centric again and people stay home and cook it more because it's expensive to go out and it becomes what it was when I was a kid, something you did rarely instead of, you know, three times a day? I mean, we've created a family lifestyle based on exploiting people's low wages. Is this an opportunity to maybe undo some of that? I don't know. I don't know where the organizing is going to take us, but it is kind of interesting to sit back and look at where the employers are finding the most difficult time finding people. And it's in childcare, it's in service industries, because those are predominantly the low-wage jobs. You know, I saw a story today that said one of the restaurants said they're no longer taking tips. They're paying all of their workers $25 an hour, and they're pricing their menus accordingly. And if I lived near there, we would go there as soon as we could, because I think that's the right model. You should not have to live off of, hey, did I smile enough? Did the person think I was nice enough to them? I want a waiter to come bring my meal in a efficient amount of time. It's got to be hot. It's got to be it's got to be done the way I want. The glass should never be empty. That's just basic service. But it shouldn't be all of the other stuff that goes into it that we hear horror stories of. And I'm excited about what the future could look like. I'm excited of the possibilities that maybe we return to a time of work mattering, of there being a reward to work. And this is something I say every time a new president comes into office. Maybe this will be the guy who returns reward to work. And I think we're seeing that. I think that we're in a moment where people have had enough. They're angry. They see the kind of obscene wealth that is being concentrated at the very top, and the fact that they're whining and complaining that they might have to pay some of it. I'm waiting for a bunch of people, we're going to move out of the country. I'm waiting for that nonsense. At which point you say, good. When you go, you don't come back, and we're going to tax all your assets here. There are consequences. But will we? And that's the other part that I have here. Because we're such a divided society, this has now become a political issue. I don't defend the IRS because I like it. I defend the IRS because we need them. It's how we fund the things that we want and need. No one ever seems to complain all that much on the right about the size of our military budget. But when we start talking about feeding children who may someday grow up big and strong enough to join the military, you don't hear a peep out of them. And maybe, I don't know, we didn't sell it right. But the fact that, you know, over my lifetime, the GOP has been the party of starving children. And you may go, Rick, that's hyperbole. The Republicans don't want to starve children. I got to tell you, the first thing I remember was Ronald Reagan cutting the school lunch program. Mr. Ketchup is a vegetable. And I remember going to the local public school in the summertime to get a free lunch. And that was gone. And for those kids, a lot of them, that was the only hot meal they got all day. But it saved a couple of pennies that we could spend on building more bombs, that we could build our Star Wars plan. Seems like we never run out of money for that kind of stuff. We never run out of money to give to the rich in the hopes. And, you know, might as well pray while you're at it, that eventually some of it will trickle down on us, that eventually it will find its way down to the rest of us. My favorite study, the Rand Corporation did, you know, that hippie liberal Rand Corporation. The thing that I like that they came up with is they said, look, you know, the working class of this country has been screwed over for the last 45 years to the tune of about $2 trillion plus each and every year. They said, I think it was something like $103 trillion in wealth was redistributed from the working class up to the investor class. And that bears reality, because you think about it. My grandparents' generation, my grandparents, when they started out, they were homeless. They got married for the old-fashioned reason, had to. Grandma got thrown out of the house because grandpa was angry. They started their lives living in the car. And through work, my grandfather getting that Teamsters job, they were able to raise three kids in a middle-class existence with health security, with retirement security. They died in the house that they raised their family in, with dignity and respect. That is not possible for the mass of people going forward. And maybe we're in a moment where some of that can change, where we can make better political decisions. But what happened? The reason generations can't do that anymore is because we gave the wealth that workers used to earn, because remember, we were a meritocracy, and we gave it to the investors because we were told they're smart. They know what to do with it. And they are, and they do. They made more money for themselves. They figured, if your suckers are going to give me your money to invest, I'm going to keep it. And they did. So we've had 40 years, and this isn't new. We've had 40 years of stagnant and declining wages for the working class of this country. And finally, we're at a moment where people are going, enough. I'm done with this. Going to be interesting to see where it plays out, because the ripple effect now is, if you got people working in restaurants making 20, 25 bucks an hour, what are the people who are making 20, 25 bucks an hour now going to demand? This is the pressure that the anti-minimum wage people are always afraid of. And it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. Could it be a short-term spasm? Maybe. Or it could be long-term. People answer that question. Do I live to work or do I work to live? We will see. Love to hear your thoughts. Am I off base? Crazy? By all means, feel free to tell me if you think I am. Love to hear that. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. Tired of Think Tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to The Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. We are radio of, for, and by we the working people. Check out our program 8 to 9 a.m. Tuesday through Saturday right here on Progressive Voices.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1875. That was the day anti-black violence erupted into a two-day massacre in Clinton, Mississippi. As many as 2,500 black Republicans and their families met at Moss Hill, a former plantation destroyed during the Civil War. The day was one of festivities and political speeches ahead of the fall elections. The county Republican Party invited local Democrats to debate. The Democratic state senatorial candidate did address the crowd. The editor of a local Republican newspaper and union officer, Captain H.T. Fisher, followed him. Soon, a group of white Democrats began to heckle Fisher as he spoke. Republican politicians attempted to quell the growing tensions. Almost immediately, however, the heckling whites opened fire on the crowd. Women and children fled in all directions as black Republican forces rushed to defend themselves and their families. By the end of the day, three whites and five blacks were killed. Clinton's mayor fed off rumors of black retaliation. He called upon white paramilitary forces, the White Liners, from surrounding areas for assistance. Several hundred answered the call and filled the town's streets. Historian Melissa Janczewski-Jones notes that though heavily armed, the White Liners accompanied white locals as they rampaged door to door looking for black Republicans to murder. After 2 days, as many as 50 black Clintonians were killed by white Democrats looking to end Reconstruction and regain political control of Mississippi. A Senate committee would later conclude, quote, "The riots at Clinton were part of a special purpose on the part of the Democrats to break up the meetings of Republicans and inaugurate an era of terror, not only in those communities, but throughout the state."
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So tomorrow is going to be a clean job summit. A climate job summit that I think is important. It's put on by the folks in organized labor. Labor Secretary Marty Walsh is going to be there. New AFL-CIO President Liz Shuler, a number of climate activists, and a number of folks there, a lot of labor folks who are going to come and talk about, hey, how do we transition to a clean economy, a one that addresses our climate issues, but still doesn't leave people, especially working people, left way behind. And, you know, as I said, you know, when Jay Inslee was running for president, I liked his climate plan because one of the first things in the plan was we've got to make labor the center of it. There have got to be jobs, and those jobs have got to be good paying jobs. We can't have a transition on poverty wages. We can't have a transition on exploitation. Can't do it again. And for me, it's the way you sell it. The way you sell it is that there are lots of jobs. In fact, you know, there was a report done that the Build Back Better plan would create 4 million new jobs. And look, you know, you start talking about the wages that come with those and the benefits. You know, these are union jobs, most of them. And, you know, as I was talking to a guy today, I go, you know, most union jobs that I know have health security to die for. I'll have retirement security that's actually gonna be there down the road, and gonna give you the opportunities that my grandparents had. So this climate summit is something I think is important. It's important that we talk about these issues, how we scale back some of the dirty stuff that we're doing, how we transition, and how we do that in a way that is not going to be horribly disruptive for people and workers. And I've said for a while, in these transitions, there has got to be something of a transition tax, some kind of a technology tax, whatever, that the people who are going to be left behind, and there will be some, unfortunately, but that they're made whole, that their lives don't go completely in the tank. And you think about all of the transitions we've had over the years. You know, when we stopped making steel in this country and steel mill workers lost their jobs, we decided to make them textile workers, and we were shipping those jobs overseas. For me, it's about making sure that families don't fall through the cracks. And this is where government can play into this. And this is where I'm hoping through these kind of summits, we get to some of that. I think it's really important. So I'm looking forward to seeing what comes out of this climate summit. If you want to take a look at it, there is a way to go over to mediaoutreach.com, and there's a way to get to find out how to participate in the big climate summit. There's also a website. We'll get links out here in a bit to the climate, to how you can take a look at that. Horrible story today out of China. Grabbed my attention. One of these things you don't often hear of in China, because not a lot comes out about the exploitation of workers. But evidently they've got this big giant company that builds properties. It's called Evergrande. They, you know, build massive complexes. And it turns out the number, I think, that they were like 80,000 apartment units behind or something, that, you know, they were just completely unfinished, basically screwed. They'd run up massive debt. There's just all kinds of horrible happening here. And what this company did is they went and they strong-armed all of their employees and said, hey, if you want to keep your bonuses that you get, you want to keep your jobs, you got to give us a short-term loan. And they sold them on the idea that they'd get their money back once they were able to complete all these apartments and they were able to complete their obligations, because evidently they were something like $300 billion in debt. So they went and they set up what the employees thought was a good deal. They're going to get their money back with a good bit of interest, because they were high yield interest loans that they gave. So they went and they scraped their savings. They went and they borrowed it from everybody they knew. They tapped friends, the relatives, you know, they stole the piggy bank money from the kids, everything. And they threw it back into the company. Well, evidently this Evergrande company decided, well, you know what? Not going to pay it back. And evidently they now face lawsuits and all kind of things from creditors. They've seen their shares lose 80% of their value this year. They are really swirling down the drain. And the reason I thought this was important is I think China is starting to look into the workers are being fleeced in ways that they haven't before. And there's going to be some kind of upheaval. And for me, there's an opportunity to reach workers across this country. Because look, we've been getting the shaft too. Not like this, but in other ways. I mean, I know people who have taken massive pay cuts when companies get themselves into trouble. They've taken massive benefit cuts. They've worked longer hours. You name it. And they end up getting stiffed. So when I look at this, I go, this is an important story in my view and something we're going to keep an eye on. But they're saying around almost 80% of these employees through this company put money into helping this Evergreen company stay afloat. I'm even more interested to see how the Chinese government will react. Because while $300 billion is a lot of money, it's not so much that they wouldn't just write it off and make people whole. So how they're going to react to this, I don't quite know. But something I think well worth looking into. And finally, this moment, I can't believe we're in this place, but Kristen Simina has again come and staked her ground. She says now that she is firmly opposed to the current prescription drug plan, which would give, you know, us the ability to negotiate Medicare prices. You can only go, well, maybe it's simply because she's in the pocket. I don't know. I don't know what's going through her head. You remember Senator Dipsy Doo was the one who did the little dance and the thumbs down over the minimum wage. It seems weird to me. But you know, she met with the president recently. They discussed the spending package, and they had hoped to talk about, you know, reducing the price of prescription drugs. Sinema made it clear that she's against the House plan. Doesn't have one of her own yet, so I'm waiting to see if like Manchin writing the climate bill, if Sinema will be writing the drug bill. And this is kind of a problem. I mean, look, if she's got a better idea, I want to hear it. Sadly, I know she doesn't. And allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices should be something that gets, you know, at least, you know, 10, 15 Republican votes, because isn't that what you want? Competition? Isn't that what we're told all the time? Let them compete. Use your bargaining power. And who has bigger bargaining power than Medicare? Oh, that's right. It depends on which side of the aisle you're on. Are you on the side of the pharmaceutical companies or the side of the people in Medicare? Oh, that's right. They're the people who are against allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices. They're on the side of the pharmaceutical companies. That's it. I knew there was a reason, and that is it. And a lot of this bears out because it looks, again, back to the money. Follow the money. Who's loading their coffers? Who's making the campaign contributions? Joe Manchin, same thing. The daughter with the damn EpiPen. Robbing people blind. We have got to get money out of politics. And quickly. Because look what it's done. The reality is what corporate America wants, corporate America gets. What you and I want, that ain't happening. Fleeced again. Gotta take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Expect rounds of heavy rainfall to continue in an area that is frankly already fully saturated.
Nicholas adds insult to injury in storm-battered Louisiana.
Clean energy future is an economic imperative and a national security imperative and an environmental imperative.
Biden continues pitch for clean energy solutions and urgent action on climate. States move to hold producers responsible for plastic pollution, plus...
Those companies include Exxon, Shell, Sunoco, and Citgo.
Vermont is the latest state to sue the fossil fuel industry for lying about global warming.
All the truth behind those lies and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
We know it's causing climate change. Human activity. This is no longer subject to debate, and And I might add, windmills do not cause cancer.
Well, that's not what I heard, Mr. President. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Dizzy Doyen, I'm afraid we're not anywhere near the end of storm season this year, and yet the storms continue to continue.
Yes, they do. In Louisiana, Tropical Depression Nicholas is tossing a wrench into the recovery from Hurricane Ida, dumping relentless rain and spawning tornadoes in areas that suffered flooding and extreme damage from Ida just 2 weeks ago. Oh. Thousands of rooftops are currently covered only in flimsy tarps. Power is slowly being restored. Nicholas is the 14th named storm of the 2021 season and the eighth storm to make landfall in the U.S. this year. The record for landfalling storms is 11, set just last year, and we still have 2.5 months to go in hurricane season.
Oh, brother, is any of this getting through to these oil states like Louisiana and Texas?
Well, President Biden warned about the costs and dangers of climate change in his remarks at the National Renewable Energy Lab in Colorado this week, pitching his Build Back Better agenda as a vital step toward fighting and adapting to climate change, and calling his clean energy proposals, quote, an economic imperative and a national security imperative that are necessary to address costly and deadly impacts.
You know, we have to invest in being more resilient because of the impacts of climate. We have to make the investments that are going to slow our contributions to climate change today, not tomorrow. And here's the good news. Something that is caused by humans can be solved by humans.
We'll see.
A key climate policy in Democrats' $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation bill passed out of one committee this week, the landmark Clean Electricity Performance Plan, which would pay utilities to accelerate the switch to clean energy. But it is facing powerful opposition from utility companies heavily invested in coal and from within the Democrats' own party. Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of the coal state of West Virginia, chairman of the Senate's Environment Committee, is also trying to eliminate the program despite its popularity in his own state. The Intercept reports that Manchin has himself profited millions every year from family investments in coal.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say it's being opposed by utility companies heavily invested in Joe Manchin.
Indeed. Meanwhile, a new study this week confirms previous research indicating that the vast majority of fossil fuel reserves owned today by countries and companies must remain in the ground to avoid the worst aspects of climate change. The researchers conclude that 90% of coal and 60% of oil and gas reserves must remain untapped for humanity to have even a 50% chance of capping global temperatures at 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. The researchers note that will require private companies and countries with nationalized oil industries to write down the value of their reserves.
Did you hear that, Joe Manchin?
More than 2,000 scientists and academics have called on the United Nations to adopt and implement a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty as the annual UN General Assembly gets underway in New York City, noting that, quote, fossil fuel impacts are global and require a global solution. The group calls for a legally binding plan for an equitable phase out of all fossil fuel production, in keeping with the global scientific consensus to not exceed 1.5 degrees of global warming. Several states are addressing plastic pollution. California passed a state law banning companies from putting the recycling symbol on items unless they can prove the material is actually recyclable.
There's an idea.
Maine and Oregon are adopting a strategy that makes plastic producers responsible for the waste that they produce instead of taxpayers by requiring producers to pay all or some of cities' recycling costs. Finally, Vermont is the latest state to sue major oil companies this week. Vermont's attorney general alleges the companies violated consumer protection laws, misleading the public in their ads and publications about the impact of their products on the climate, deceiving Vermonters since at least the 1960s.
I'll take it. For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So according to the book Peril, which is supposed to be coming out by Bob Woodward and Robert Costa, evidently Donald Trump floated the idea that he was going to repaint his private plane to look just like Air Force One, simply to troll Joe Biden. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds childish. That sounds like something that now the problem is I don't think he'd pay for it. So maybe if Mexico would pay for it, maybe that would happen. But Mexico is not going to pay for it. It's never going to happen. But again, more little childishness that comes out of the former administration. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, our good friend Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick.
What are you thinking? Should Trump repaint the plane?
Yeah, I mean, if he wants to, if he pays for it, you know, I guess he can do it. He would have to use the seal as former. I think he'd have to write former on it if he wanted to use the seal.
Yes, so. I was going to ask you about that because you know, that's something that's pretty specific. I mean, and it's never been done before. I fully see him capable of doing something like that, but it just seems kind of childish to me.
You can use, you know, like a congressman is a former. If you're writing. With stationery, you can put former member of Congress. People will address former members as sometimes as congressmen or, former presidents or presidents. But you can't say current. Probably Trump would put a date on there, you know. Air Force One, next year, March the 6th, you know, something like that. I mean, I'm amazed. He just wrote this letter Friday. To Secretary of State of Georgia, he won't stop. He wrote a letter, wanting him to decertify the election.
Jesus.
I mean, he won't stop. And he wrote that, and he said, you know, to do what? I think he quoted, you know, to do what you know should be done, and had officially asked him. That's what Friday, I think it was. Yes, and officially asked him. To decertify the election all of these months later. He refers to the 43,000 absentee ballots that he claims violate the chain of custody. Now, the response by the Secretary of State is that, you know, they've looked at this twice. And, you know, he won by what? Biden won by 12,000 votes. Well, people have won, you know, by less than that within states, and they're, you know, still certified. Jim Rhodes, when he ran against Governor Gilligan years ago, won by, I think, 9 or 10,000 votes. And, you know, he was the governor. And so Biden's been certified twice.
Right. The story in Florida goes Al Gore won by what? Or lost by what? Like 460-something? 500?
Right. Well, yeah, just around 500. It was one county, and then Catherine Harris certified that, and then went to Supreme Court. Yes, that's true. It was 400 and some votes.
So you don't see Al Gore still writing letters going, hey, decertify that.
Right. And in the letter to Raffensperger, Trump said that people do not understand why you and Governor Brian Kemp adamantly refuse to acknowledge the now proven facts. Now, remember, he starts the letter off by saying, you know, take a look at this and, you know, if it comes to basically to light, then you would decertify. And now in the same letter, he says, but we don't know why, you know, it's proven because Rudy Giuliani says, you know, it's proven.
Yeah, and the MyPillow guy says, yeah, yeah.
Just do it. Yeah. I know a lot of things he's capable of. It seriously caught me off guard, though, that this was still asked on Friday. No. It coincided, of course, you know, with the 400 and some people that attended the, you know, defend the rioters rally in D.C.
Yeah, which is crazy. But here's the thing. I mean, I give Raffensperger, I give him a little bit of credit for, you know, not going along with this.
Right.
But he did try and purge enough. He did purge enough votes in Georgia that Trump should have won. I mean, almost 200,000 people they threw off the voting rolls.
Right.
So, right. I mean, there's enough, you know, I think Raftsenparger did enough to help him win. I just think it didn't happen. But let's move along. Debt ceiling back again.
Right.
Evidently the White House says, no, they're not going to mint a $1 trillion coin.
I like that. What did you think about that?
Curious. At the end of the day, we literally can print money. It's what we do. We can print money. So it would be easier. We'd save trees. One coin, $1 trillion. I can see that.
You know, this was discussed, I guess, when President Obama was in office. They had just talked about they weren't going to do it. But I thought, you know, it doesn't have to be a big coin, just the size of a quarter. If you just say it's a trillion,
yeah.
You know, but they're not going to do that. This one's interesting because of the fact that if the Republicans don't provide any votes, then the quote, you know, shutdown would be, you know, in the hands, blame-wise, also in their hands. Of course, Social Security checks, the veterans checks, everything would stop. And with the amount of debt we have now, it's even more precarious than it would have been, you know, maybe 8 or 9 years ago. So I don't know. Let's see what they do. I just can't imagine they will let it roll into, you know, default. I mean, after all, the debt ceiling pays for debt already encumbered is basically what it does.
Right.
Again, I think the biggest gimmick I've ever seen in years, though, was the 2 years where they, with Trump administration, got the sign off just ignore it for 2 years. You know, they just kind of kicked it down the road. This would be, since World War II, the 100th time, by the way. Nothing new.
Yeah, no, we've only now made it a big deal over these last couple of years, especially when there's a Democrat in the White House, because I don't remember there being a hostage situation during the Trump years, and they did raise the debt ceiling a couple of times during the Trump years.
They did, and again, they did something that I hadn't seen before, which was to stave it off, just basically say you didn't have to renew it for a two-year period. During the Bush administration, people would, you know, complain about it a little bit, but I was there for, you know, many times when you just it was raised without, you know, a lot of fanfare. With Obama, it became do or die, you know, whether they were going to raise it or not, but they would raise it. Now they're bluffing the Republican side, I think. I can't imagine where they let the government come to, you know, a halt. Again, money already encumbered through the process of continuing budgets.
Right, already allocated and headed out the door. This is just a matter of paying the bills. Now, I understand Senate Democrats have unveiled a new plan that they're going to fund through the end of December, and I'm going, I don't know, is that long enough? It's September now. We're going to get to the end of this month, and then right after Christmas, we're going to have to do this crap again. Can't we do like the former guy did and just say, you know what, we'll wait till the end of the term?
Well, they could. They're trying to cut a deal. They basically have, you know, historically done this before. Now, when it goes into an election year, though, it's very fascinating because usually you will see both parties say, well, let's do this for a longer period of time.
Yeah, we don't want anybody to realize what numbers. So, but let me ask you this, because Democrats do, if you can hold all 50, can't you do this through the budget reconciliation process? Do you need Republicans in this?
No, I don't think you would. It would depend on, you know, you can do anything through reconciliation that the parliamentarian says you can. Now, of course, the parliamentarian, she just did down the immigration. You
know, right.
They couldn't do that. But obviously, debt ceiling is a clearly, purely economic factor, which is what fits into reconciliation.
I mean, couldn't you just tie this to the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill and be done with it?
Well, they could. Of course, that's a problem. Right now, they need, they're looking towards 20 Republicans for that vote, you know, which they could do that, but they're looking towards trying to get 20 Republicans September 27th because the progressives are upset. So a lot of the progressives have said they won't vote for that.
Does it happen?
There's a lot of, the House is in a lot of, you know, precarious situations now.
Yeah, does it happen? I mean, will that bipartisan bill get through? Because both Manchin and Sinema have both said the bipartisan, or the partisan bill, the $3.5 trillion, is dead in the water. Do you see the $1.2 trillion bipartisan bill going through on the 27th?
I think it has a potential to go through. The Republican, quote, moderate caucus, I think it has 20 members now. They're trying to get votes. Fred Upton of Michigan, Trump's after him. But Fred is trying to get votes. I serve with Fred Upton, and he's a moderate. So if he can get at least 10 going right now, it should probably lead to 20. Look, there's a lot of states that, you know, the governors of both parties, local officials, they've taken a look at what's in that bill, and they want it. The Democrat side needs a bill to come out, because if they're, you know, in trouble with the $3.5 trillion, which they are because of Senator Manchin, then they at least have to have the infrastructure bill. And, again, they may get close to 20 Republican votes for that. So I would give that a nod that it, you know, has the potential to pass. The $3.5 trillion, which is starting to, again, we've talked about this on your show, at some point in time, Senator Schumer, Senator Manchin, because Senator Manchin will not give, need to sit down and say, okay, what is the absolute final number? Does it go from $1.5 trillion by Manchin to $1.8 trillion or whatever? And then they're going to have to accept that and plug everything in there that's needed and come up with the language to fit into whatever it's going to be. I keep saying 1.7, 1.8 trillion because Manchin said originally, what, one trillion?
Right.
Now 1.5 trillion. Plug it in, change the language. You know, there's some new ideas and programs created. Call it a day, call it a win, wrap it in reconciliation, and go for it. Then you've got the infrastructure bill passed and the human infrastructure bill.
Yeah, and you get it into law, and then down the road you work to make it.
Two wins.
You work to get it funded. Right. That makes perfect sense. But you've now got Sinema, who is drawing a line in the sand, saying if they delay that 27th vote, that, you know, next week that vote, she's absolutely positively under no circumstances going to vote for the reconciliation.
Right. Look, Manchin has always been the out front, you know, voice. She's always been in the background, you know, wanting Manchin to achieve some type of deal, you know, to spare her from having to do what she's just done, you know, which is to say, well, I'm not going to be for it. Then again, some of the progressives have told the speaker they're not going to vote for the $1.2 trillion. So the way this can work, the speaker gets, you know, 20 Republican votes. They pass the $1.2 trillion without the progressives, so they're not on record and they don't hurt their own cause. Then they yield, well, I'm talking about the Senate, not the House. Then they yield to Manchin's number. They adjust everything for that number. And then the progressives can argue, you know, they don't like it. It needs to be more, but they are going to get portions of what they want. And then it makes it. It'll pass.
Okay. So if you're handicapping this, you think Pelosi gets those Republicans to move over, they get the bipartisan thing through the Senate, it makes it, you know, the makes everything nice. We get something moved, and maybe get the reconciliation next year, or not at all.
I would handicap it that the speaker will be able to get the $1.2 trillion. That she's, I'm going to place my bets on that. I think she would be successful at the $3.5 trillion, which will be reduced if the Senate would begin to come to reality with, you know, whether they like it or they don't is irrelevant, but come to reality of what Manchin wants. And then they can move something, I would imagine, early within the first of the year.
Okay, because Manchin's come out and said, we're going to wait till next year, and I know you're going to really tick off of the progressive wing of the party by not getting something done alongside with this bipartisan bill, with the $1.2 trillion bill. So again, I'm going to be interested to see how it plays out. I'm with you. I think we end up getting the hard infrastructure.
Right.
I don't think you get the other stuff.
I think they have to have the hard infrastructure bill. And then the other thing is, you know, about the $3.5 trillion, they all can take it into where it becomes an internal political civil war of the Democrat side, the progressives against Manchin, et cetera, et cetera. It's a weird situation. He is the 50th vote, and that's the way it is. You know, take a win on that one. You just reduce the price. You still get the language you want, which is a major change in the last 30 years.
No, it's stuff that we need, right. And I'm with you on that.
Right.
Finally, I wanted to get your thoughts on the evidently we're allowing people to fly. Was it overseas if they've been vaccinated? Walk me through what we did today.
Well, the president has basically has said that, you know, people can fly, and in this would be applying to, you know, all the major airlines, and they would be able to, you know, we would have people being able to fly to the United States if they're vaccinated, you know, and they have proof of the vaccination. Then obviously we would assume the rest of the world is going to comply, you know, with us. And they've been working on this a while. So we would be basically lifting the ban on vaccinated foreign travelers, and that would be this week. You know, if you've had your vaccination, you know, you can travel. And what kind of gets me about this is that the United Kingdom, you know, the Prime Minister Boris is making a deal about this, that, you know, they didn't know. They didn't know that this had been going on. There's an official appointed U.S.-United Kingdom joint task force that's been working on restarting travel between the countries, you know, since they had the G7 summit. This isn't a real shocker. But I don't know why anyone thinks that, well, President Biden has to, you know, particularly before he decides this, make a phone call and sort of get the sign off of the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. This affects the world, is what we're doing. This isn't just an English, American deal.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe the former guy did. Maybe you know, Boris was first on his list.
Well, no, they were close. That's true.
Well, they were. I mean, you know, they had the same kind of crazy hair.
Right, and then they're saying, well, you know, they caught their ally by surprise. Well, you know, it's not like we, you know, undid a trade agreement with the United Kingdom and didn't tell them. So I think it's a good thing the president's approaching it with people that, you know, are vaccinated, and it starts to relieve, you know, some of the decision-making of other airlines, because we are not allowed to fly into certain countries now. So this should make some reciprocity, again, if you have proof. And then you have to take a COVID test. There's other rules to this, you know, 3 days before and then afterwards. So I think there's enough safeguards, you know, with the travel and, of course, masks.
No, I'm right there with you. I'm going to be flying soon as well, so we're going to go through all that as well.
Right. I flew with my daughter and her family, and, you know, you wear the mask, and, you know, now international, it'll be a little bit different. You've got to have the COVID test.
Now, did you see anybody get duct taped to their seat?
No, but there's a couple people that were complaining. I wish they would have maybe duct taped them to the wing of the airplane.
There you go. That's what I'm kind of hoping for. I'm hoping they duct tape someone to a seat. And I hope it's not.
Just as long as, you know, I'm sure Carol's hoping it's not you, you know.
It wouldn't be me. Not going to be me.
Okay.
Not going to be me.
There we go.
Nope, not going to be me. Whatever you need. But, Bob, I appreciate the time. Always
Thank
great to
you,
talk
Rick.
With you.
You too. Thank you.
Our good friend Bob Ney. You know, seriously, you know, we're going to Alaska in a couple of weeks. I've got an engagement out that way. You know, Teamsters Local 959 is bringing me out to speak to their membership and be part of their convention and their training sessions. And I always love going out and talking with the guys there in Anchorage and having an opportunity to, you know, anytime you get a chance to talk with workers and anytime you get a chance to, you know, to share stories and hear the challenges of other working people and how things are in different states. I always like doing it, but I'm looking forward to that. And we're going to take the family with us you know, see the Northern Lights and make a little vacation out of it as well, which is, you know, a great opportunity for us. Because, you know, how many times you get a chance to go to Alaska and see what's there before climate change makes it, you know, a summer paradise year round. Because we were there, you know, a couple of years ago, and, you know, we went to see the glaciers, and the noise that they make as they melt just was incredible to me. And we sat on this boat, basically floating in what was a giant, you know, ice cube bowl, as these glaciers were basically melting off into the water. And it's frightening, because we went into some places where, you know, they told you, look, this entire area, 20 years ago was nothing but ice, and it's all gone. There's nothing left. There's nothing to regenerate. There's nothing to refreeze. It's gone. It's never coming back. And, you know, it's an important part of our, of, you know, how our country, you know, gets fresh water. It's an important part of, you know, how, you know, the climate is affected. But it was scary stuff. But I loved Alaska. The weirdest thing to me was, you know, the sun came, we were there in, I think, June or July. It was July. And the sun came up at like 5:30 in the morning and didn't set till almost midnight, which is one of the weirdest things I've ever encountered. I guess now we're going to go and it'll, you know, maybe the sun will come up at noon and set at 3 o'clock. I guess that's winter time though. But you know, I'm looking forward to it anyway. Good opportunities there. But again, I appreciate Bob coming on and sharing some thoughts. Now, you know, look, you know, I'm looking at this infrastructure bill. I'm looking at, you know, the hope that we get something. I think we're going to get the hard infrastructure bill, because you're going to get Republicans to come along. I think that's going to happen. Not so sure about the other one, but I like what Bob said. Look, take what you can get. If you can get $1 trillion through reconciliation, it's a massive win. You've now put programs into place, and now we fight to fund them fully. That to me is the way forward. That's the way that, and I get, you know, pitching and screaming that it's not enough, it's not big enough. I get that. I get the fact that we want things fully funded. I get that. But, you know, to me, politics has always been the art of the possible. And you don't give up something because you think you can get something perfect down the road. You get what you get, and you make it better going forward. You get those programs into place, and you move forward doing it. Just seems like the right thing. And look, as much as Sinema and Manchin are driving me crazy, because this should have been done already. We should have this money going out the door, helping rebuild our economy, getting people the job training that we need to get them in. And look, I know it's a tough time, but we could be creating really good jobs for people and rebuilding our economy and helping families. We could be doing the things that we want to do. I think that's exciting. I think we're in an exciting moment to where now finally the needs of we the people are being, you know, somewhat looked at. They're not being addressed yet, but somewhat looked at. That there's someone who seems to care a little bit. And it certainly wasn't the former guy in the last administration. Because they did nothing on health care. They did nothing on retirement. They did nothing on job creation. Except, well, you know, during the pandemic, we saw the whole thing collapse under them. They inherited a heated economy and, well, through a massive debt-laden tax bill, didn't get the kind of growth that we should have gotten for that kind of spending. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Follow us on social media at Rick Smith Show. Facebook, throw us a like. YouTube, subscribe, maybe share, grab the notifications. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.